I continue to be John Atack despite all of my best efforts to do otherwise. And this is my new friend Sean McCraney. And
Hi.
I've said this before, as the two times we talked before, that I just find your situation fascinating. So for anybody who hasn't looked at the other two videos, and you should go away and look at them, Sean is classifiably probably a sociopath. I think that's the word we might choose. Somebody without conscience, without empathy, who started out that way. And in 1997, he had a roadside experience, and from that experience, decided he was going to change his life and his behavior. And you've worked hard at it since then. He has the most wonderful Old Testament prophet beard, which I think is a big selling feature. Look at that, incredible. You grew up in the Mormons, pretty much, with a mum who encouraged your antisocial behavior,
Yes, she
and
did.
you were keen on sex and drugs and rock and roll for a long time,
Yes.
with a side of violence thrown in. And since 1997, you have sought to redeem yourself. But I think what is most important to me, and I will stop talking at some point, is that you're not saying, "I accepted Jesus and everything's been fine since then." You're
No.
saying, "I accepted Jesus and I have to work at it every day."
Yes,
Yeah.
absolutely. Yes.
And I
Yeah.
think,
You'll go ahead.
no, you go ahead, but please, by all means.
Well, and that's kind of there is the initial emotive response you would have at a roadside experience or whatever metaphysical thing I assume I had. There is this initial rebirth, so to speak. But you do have that, and it's emotional, but it's not what fixes you. It just undergirds your resolve to be fixed and encourages you with an option to choose if you are what you say you are. Now, if I say I'm going to be a follower of this person, Buddha, Islam, Jesus, if I say I'm following them, I should follow them if I'm authentic, and authenticity is important to me. So I had the roadside experience, which gave me all I can say is like the impetus to see I there is a way to manage this person that I was came into this world with. There is a way. Somebody in your comments on one of the shows or one of our interviews said, "Sounds like AA." And I wrote,
Higher power, yeah.
higher power. And without a doubt, but AA, all my daughter's in AA and it works for her wonderfully. But what it does is it just echoes the biblical sentiment if you read it with integrity and you didn't try to input all kinds of traditions. It basically gives the AA message, and that is you're not so great. There's something bigger than you. If you want to be a decent human being, humble yourself to whatever that thing is and submit to what it says. And that's what I have to do daily. I have to submit and humble myself to what that power I've chosen to align myself with says. And I then follow that, and I do it because I'm grateful for what that higher power in my mind has done for me. Now, that's the logical assessment of it. Other people, they'll say they came to see Jesus and they stopped being an alcoholic on that day. Well, I can't dispute it if they have, but that's not me.
And I think that
More.
the term authenticity becomes highly relevant because I have, of course, lived a long life and met many people and seen how much we tend to pretend, how much, how hypocritical we are. And so that quest for authenticity for you, I think that's something that we have in common.
Yeah.
That, when I can remember, I was 14 years old and I decided I wanted to know the truth,
Oh, yeah.
whatever that was, even if it was unpleasant. And I don't know it.
Yeah.
but it's been fun looking, you know. Yeah. And I have come to a, you know, I'm very lucky. I have a happy life after 10 decades of years of turmoil, largely because I poked the Scientology monster and it decided to try and devour me. And it's sort of, if you think back, you go, we have 40,000 people with $2 billion versus me.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that a good choice?
That means you're onto something, John.
Well, I wish I knew what, because I could bottle it and sell it, couldn't I? Right. Well, we said that I've asked that we go through the characteristics of a human predator, which I put forward in my tome, Opening Our Minds. And I'm fascinated to have your comment, your agreement, your disagreement, whatever, to see how this feels to you. And I'll say that I studied this problem in the 1980s because I wanted to understand Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology. And I talked with a couple of psychiatrists along the way, one of whom said, and this is a psychiatrist called Frank Sarge Gabodi, who was himself a Scientologist, the only psychiatrist ever to become a Scientologist. Very, very clever man. And we talked at some length over a period of weeks. And eventually he said, well, yeah, Hubbard was nuts. And that was his psychiatric diagnosis.
Wow.
However, talking with Louis Jolyon West, which has got me into a lot of trouble because people are absolutely, you know, convinced that he must have worked for the CIA. Uh-huh. I don't think he did, but I think just about anybody in the field will have got funding at some point from the CIA in the 60s, particularly.
Wow.
Because almost all psychological research was funded by the US military industrial complex at that time. Mm-hmm. So he may well have, but nonetheless, talking with him, and he'd encountered Hubbard's work first, and I think in 1951. And started protesting and spent the next 40 years being very public in his disdain about Hubbard and Scientology, which would not be consistent with the idea that some people have put forward that Jolly West was a psychopath, because a psychopath wouldn't waste his time, you know, attacking a stupid cult group. I mean, what's the payoff in that, you know? But I came away from those conversations still really unsure about what I was dealing with. And then I came back to it in the around about 2015. I decided that we really have to be aware that there are people in the world who are predatory. They don't care about other people. Other people are prey. And having fallen, you know, into that trap myself many times with people, it seemed to be, I don't really care what the psychiatric diagnosis for this is, psychopath, sociopath, malignant narcissist, antisocial personality disorder, Machiavellian, and on and on. That's not what concerns me. What concerns me is, can we recognize if somebody it does have a predatory nature and protect ourselves? You know, not necessarily, in fact, definitely not do anything to hurt the predator. And it seemed to me that to call people with any of these dispositions human predators, and not to get into the Goldwater rule, that US idea that you can't diagnose somebody that you haven't talked to, but to be able to say, well, this person is doing these things. So I put forward this list of characteristics. I'm sure we'll put them up in the description, in the links. You can get your own free fridge poster to you know, have
and
a look
at
every day.
It's a great poster.
Oh, it's thank
beautiful.
You.
Yeah.
Spike designed it, so she'll be thrilled that you said
that. She did a great
job. Yeah. I think so too. She's brilliant. She does wonderful work. Could not do any of this without her. We've done, I don't know, 450 videos. She's edited them all. I wouldn't know where to begin. So
wow.
And I can't get my earpiece to go in properly either. So that's how.
Isn't it a blessing to have people like Spike?
I'm sorry.
Isn't it a blessing to have people like Spike?
I think so, and absolutely. We've worked together for 8 years now, and she saw me talk at a conference in Dublin in February 2015, and she went, I want to work with this man. Mm. And it's not done her a lot of good. But there you go.
I don't believe that for a second.
It's a good relationship. It's certainly not done her a lot of good financially. Because
the best things don't.
No, it's true, and it is. It's interesting, isn't it, that what we set ourselves upon, what we want to achieve in life, and I'm just so incredibly lucky that I've survived at all, given what I've gone through, and I have a nice house. It isn't mine, but I live in a nice house, and I have enough money to get by on. But realizing that people are conditioned in our society to earn money, to earning money, and there's that little thing that Jesus said about God or Mammon.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mammon is money. Yeah. Mammon is capitalism, and we have this. You know, it got to me in school. I just couldn't accept the Christianity I was being sold because it came packaged with corporate capitalism. And it's like, these are opposites.
I am with you. Exactly.
Yeah. So the first characteristic that I list, because it seems the most obvious one, is meanness. That human predators are mean. And if somebody is mean to you once, it might mean that they're in a bad place and they need help. If they're mean to you 100 times, it means you're in a bad place.
So I
put it at the top of the list because it seems the simplest of things. Do you have any comment upon that?
Yeah, ashamedly, when I look back, that's a hallmark characteristic of a predator, because you have to dehumanize the person down to a place where they are insignificant. They have no basis. You hate them. You hate their visage. You hate the way they talk. You want to destroy them. And so you're going to be automatically mean to it, to break it down. And that was very much part of my personality and still can be if I don't watch it. But, I found that I am most remorseful for the meanest things I've done. Mm. Meanness is so harmful to other people's souls. And I never really could see that until I had children and I started to see what mean things, because people would try to be mean to me and it would hurt me internally, but I would just hurt them back.
Yeah.
But when you have children, they can't do that. So you start to get some empathy. Yeah.
That's really interesting. And from our earlier conversations, it's evident that the relationship with your daughters is the primary relationship in your life. That they're the
definitely
most important thing. Yeah. All right. So moving on to predators are utterly selfish.
Yeah. I kind of think that everybody is. In the end, I think that, you know, I think it was Thomas Hobbes, and I could be wrong, was talking about that the man is just innately selfish. And when the rubber meets the road, if you're starving and there's one biscuit left, you know, in the end, most people will take it. So selfishness is just, it's just part and parcel of anybody who has a personality disorder in mind. But I think selfishness is almost like central to the human experience. Mm. You know, we are just, our babies, they have to learn to share. I mean, we're just kind of innately selfish, don't you think?
Not quite. I think what you say about selfishness being foundational for all personality disorders is probably true. Unless we're talking about the dependent personality disorder, which is, I think that we've got far too much of that. And those people are not innately selfish. They are innately submissive to the point of masochism. So I think that can happen as a disorder, but otherwise, you know, narcissists and antisocial personality disorder. And I think there's a differentiation here, and I'm so glad you bring this up. When Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister in Britain in 1979, she put a book on the table at her first cabinet meeting, we're told, which was a book by a man called von Hayek. And she said, this will be our Bible. And what came out of that was absolutely this belief that we're selfish and that anybody that says otherwise is dishonest. And there was a survey used on our civil service to determine whether they believed they were doing what they were doing for their own advancement and to satisfy their own greed of gain, or they were doing it for other people altruistically. And whoever answered that they wanted to help other people was downgraded. Yeah. And whoever said, no, I'm a selfish bastard, was advanced. And yeah. I think we come to a very dangerous point. I think the satisfaction I get out of life, I divide into two sets of ideas. One is I take pleasure from life. So, you know, every day, I admit it, I eat some chocolate. It's just the way it is. It's good chocolate. I don't eat the cheap stuff. I eat the nice, well, I don't eat the expensive stuff because it's gone for it. But I eat, you know, 85% cocoa chocolate. That gives me pleasure, and it's something I can look forward to. But then there's happiness. And I had a conversation. I was in a Zen monastery when I was 18. I had a conversation with the abbot, and which was brilliant. I was only there for 3 days, you know, before anybody gets excited about me being a Zen master or any nonsense like that. It's a dreadful cult. I'm not going to go there. But this guy was really smart. And he said, you can never be happy. That's the mistake that people make. They think they can achieve happiness. And I went away from that conversation feeling a little deflated. And I think he was wrong. I think you can be happy. And this is where I disagree with the notion of selfishness, that I think that happiness comes from knowing that you've benefited another person. And I've been very fortunate. A few weeks ago, a woman wrote to me and she said, we had a phone conversation for an hour in 1994 that changed my life. And I'm happily married, have kids, have a career. And I didn't do anything magical. All I did was listen to her and answer her questions. She wanted to know if the person she was involved with, that if she was involved in a cult. And I probably gave a relatively complex answer to that, because you know me, I do. I think the word cult's a bit simplistic. But I gave her the answer she needed to hear, and everything changed for her. This is, I'm so lucky. This has happened to me a number of times over the years. And that's the selfishness in that becomes the extension of the self into other people, saying, you know, and that can be my family, my tribe, you know, my town, my county, my nation. That one's a really bad one. What people will do on behalf of this completely invented concept of the nation. They don't exist. It's not true. There's no such thing. It's a fantasy. Or humanity. And for me, that sense of seeking to do something good, and there probably is a degree of smugness in it too. It's, you know, let's not, I am not St. Francis of Assisi and never will be. But that, and I think there's also this thing about that I think some Christians mistake, which is the idea that they're meant to, St. Francis is a good example, they're meant to sacrifice themselves to the world. My idea is not that at all. I think we should have pleasure in life, look after ourselves, look after the self, make sure that, you know, we bathe and get exercise, eat properly, especially, you know, making sure we get some chocolate every day. But we should also experience the pleasure. And maybe this is, you know, maybe we've hit something very significant here, that you don't feel this. And because, forgive me, you are a very clever man. You've thought about this and you've said, well, probably Margaret Thatcher and von Hayek were right, that people do things out of selfish motivation. But there can also be a selfish motivation for your own children, where you include them and you will sacrifice things for their happiness, and it will make you happy that you did it.
Right.
And then you can be selfish towards your tribe, towards, you know, your nation, which I say are difficult because explosives become involved very easily in that one. But that it's a matter of what we consider to be the self almost, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So,
and that's why we have that paradox of men like ruthless gangsters who love their family. You know, we have these compartmentalizations that we appeal to get by in life. I differ with you, John, in the idea of happiness, though. I almost have a Zen-like idea of happiness myself. I think it is all very circumstantial. And I think that even the most altruistic soul doing their best, if they are maligned in the process, their self will take over and become embittered, angry, resentful, something in the face of that. True selflessness, I don't think exists, because I think we have defense mechanisms to prohibit ourselves from being completely derided, you know, Christ on the cross, totally submit your strengths, die to self, give it for the world type ideas. I'm not sure that exists in anybody. I feel like even the most docile, altruistic Mother Teresa will get pissed off and do something selfish when she's put to a point. But that's my worldview. What I think you're experiencing personally is a joy from, and I think there's a difference. That joy is when you give to another. And when you start to do that in real selflessness, I'm giving my time, my money to another, I really think that is a joy that cannot be taken away. But I think that joy can also be, won't be mitigated by bad treatment of you. So if I'm doing something nice and someone treats me badly, I am not going to respond negatively if it's from a place of joy. But no. So am I getting too in the weeds on this?
No, I think what you say is highly relevant. And I think the kind of spectrum from selfless to selfish becomes interesting. I tend to agree with you that I'm not sure that I've ever done anything selfless.
Yeah, right. That's what Hobbes was saying. Yohobisi, and no one does anything selflessly. We always have a motive, even if it's to make ourselves feel better, right? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, to a significant extent. When I was a teenager, one of my brothers, my brother Jamie, who's a very smart guy, said, you know, we never do anything that doesn't please us. So therefore, we're all egotistical. And that stayed with me all my life and been a very interesting gauge that I've never considered myself to be noble in any way. You know, the sacrifice, I was harassed for 16 years solid by Scientology. And I can't reason my way towards any benefit to me, other than it made me the guy who resisted 16 years of harassment, which is, you know, you can't put that on a certificate on your wall.
Well, that was imposed upon you, wasn't it? Or did you impose that harassment upon yourself?
I could have at any point, you know, they offered to, the last offer in, I think, 1994, and I have a recording of the phone conversation, which I won't be publishing because I'm afraid I was a bit rude in it. But a representative of Scientology said, how about we have an art gallery that buys your paintings and puts you on a monthly salary? And you don't say anything else about Scientology. So I was offered a life's income to walk away from it. And I was rude to him, as I say.
You got character, buddy. That's what you've got. Good for you.
You could look at it that way, or you could say that looking at it the other way, that he pissed me off.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah, but what kept you going and taking the abuse for 16 years if there was no benefit to you at all?
Well, I think there was a benefit to me, and that was the benefit of understanding that because I'd been, you know, I had 9 years in Scientology, and I'd had the good fortune never to be a living member. So I was never controlled. I was never abused or humiliated. And about a year after I left, I came to realize I hadn't met anybody else that was true of. Everybody else had been humiliated, abused. Many of them, you know, would come away with complex post-traumatic stress disorder. I had nothing like that. I was fine. I just walked out of the door and was at the middle of the independent Scientology movement. So that's what drove me initially, the thought that Scientology was a good thing and the world needed it and it would improve the world. And then about 3 months in, I realized that Ron Hubbard was a con man and a shyster. And the next phase from that was personal, which was not being able to persuade people of my fellow, you know, they were people who'd left the mother cult of Scientology, but still believed and were still practicing the very elaborate control rituals of Scientology, the hypnotic rituals of Scientology. And I would say, look, here Hubbard says I'm a war hero, and here Hubbard says I didn't see service. I didn't see combat, rather. He saw service. And I'd show that to a Scientologist, and they'd go, well, so what? You know, of course he's both things. In fact, I think I may have mentioned this before when I put this to one woman and said, look, here's him saying he was crippled and blinded at the end of World War II. And here's him saying that he fell down a ship's ladder and that was the worst thing that happened to him. It's an article in Look magazine of November, December 1950. And I said this to this one woman, and she just looked at me and said, well, you know, this was about him having, he claimed he'd beaten up three petty officers in Hollywood on July the 25th, 1945, and yet he's meant to be crippled and blinded. And she just looked at me and said, well, solution to that's easy. He had two bodies. It's like, you've got me there.
Whoa.
I hadn't thought about that possibility. So see it, those mechanisms in people, how we defend ourselves from evidence, how our cognitive dissonance rises up, and our confirmation bias, that which doesn't agree with us, we will think we are critical thinkers when we find some clever way of dismissing evidence. That, sure. So there was that. And then there was the, well, who was this guy Hubbard? And I became fascinated. And a lot of people came to me who were broken or damaged. And it took me about 7 years to work out how to have a conversation with somebody that would allow them to rethink their involvement, you know, wouldn't bring up their ego defenses, so we were in some kind of argument about it, but it would allow them to be safe and comfortable, to understand that I am an authority on this subject, I really know far too much about it, and to then recalibrate themselves and change their mind about how they wanted to think, without doing this, which is usually the case, without trying to inflict my own beliefs on them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in some ways, it's many different things. It was to sort myself out, though I didn't, as I say, I wasn't traumatized. I was actually, even after all the harassment from Scientology in 1996, a significantly good psychiatrist who was a friend of mine, because I was being accused of being mentally ill, I had her assess me, and she did a complete assessment. And the surprise of us both, given that I'd had 12 years of harassment by this time, I didn't have the symptoms of PTSD. I didn't have any, you know, symptoms of any disorder as far as she could see. As I said to you when we talked before, I personally think I suffer from the empathy disorder.
Yeah.
And I also have the order disorder, that I like things to be systematically placed. So I think there's also a differentiation, which is about the spite spectrum, that if somebody does something to me that, you know, they don't turn up for an appointment, say, which we had when we were meant to meet the other week, I couldn't care less. It means nothing to me. The fundamental attribution error in psychology says that I will think that they are trying to get at me, and I will want to punish them in some way. And I don't think I've ever had that set of emotions. I don't want revenge. So this is, I think, relevant to what you said before, that if David Miscavige, who runs Scientology now, wanted to have a conversation with me, as long as he promised not to shout at me or hit me, I'd be perfectly happy to do that. And if I could help him, even though I do think he is a deeply predatory human being, if I could help him, I would. Mm-hmm. So I think that's
fascinating. Because to me, listening to you, it sounds like the onus, the genesis of all of who you are, can be stated in what you said earlier. I wanted to know the truth.
Yes.
That seems like something very important to you. And therefore, that would be the non-altruistic side of what you're doing. You yes. want the truth.
Yeah.
And so you are serving that need. Mm. But what's interesting to hear you is it seems like you became altruistic toward those involved because you understood the information, you weren't linked to it, and now you can help. I mean, that's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is the, you know, I don't think that, that thoughts and emotions are separate. I don't think thinking and feeling are separate. I think that's a, it's a, an easy mistake to make. But my need to understand, rather than to be comforted, rather than to have some fantasy sold to me about what the world is and how it works. And I think we're similar in that. From what you've said about your religious belief, you know, I absolutely respect how you've come to that belief and the humility with which you express that belief. I was going to say before, it's interesting, you mentioned Islam going past. Of course, the word Islam means submission. Mm. And we take it out of Arabic. And I think that submission to a higher power or you know, I don't have... I've never had, or since I was 13, I've not had a personal idea of God. So God as a person. Mm. And I think what Maimonides, you know, almost 1,000 years ago says in The Guide of the Perplexed. So he's a Jewish philosopher living in Islamic Spain, in Andalusia. And he opens his book by saying, of course, when it says in Genesis that man is created in the image of God, it does not mean physically. And it's sort of going, now this is smart guy, you know, he's understood that this is not, you know, the terrible Michelangelo God sticking his finger out. This, how on earth something so blasphemous could decorate the Vatican Chapel. But there you go, people are strange animals. That we're not dealing with a guy, big guy with a lovely beard like yours. We're dealing with the foundation of the universe. We're dealing with what underlies everything and that out of which everything came. And for me, I'm satisfied with the Chinese notion of Tao, that there is something that I cannot understand and I'm going to give it a name, but it doesn't mean I understand it. And you know, I was 17 when I first read the Tao Te Ching, and since then I've read, I don't know, 50 or 60 versions and 50 commentaries and translated it myself. And and it's one way of looking at things. And it's a way that I'm comfortable with to say, because the other end of it, the kind of atheist end of it, and I guess, you know, believe in the Tao and be an atheist. But that end of that smug kind of, I know everything and everything can be reduced to nuts and bolts and mechanics. Mm-hmm. Not really. It's as Stephen Jay Gould said in Countering Dawkins, that there are two separate magisteria. There is the magisterium of science and quantity and measurement, and there is the magisterium of qualia, of quality. Robert Pirsig gives the same argument in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Forget it, my favorite book.
I read it when I was about 20, and it had a phenomenal influence.
All about quality.
Yeah.
Value. Yeah, and you know the backstory to him, Pirsig, and how he went to and was with a Zen master, and he was in a classroom, and he was following Zen, and he asked the Zen master in Japan, hey, is the suffering at Nagasaki real? And the Zen master said, no, it's not real. And he said he got up and he left. He said that was it for Zen, because...
yeah.
That study on quality is amazing.
Yeah,
it's mind-blowing masterpiece,
and that we have to integrate the two things. I mean, he's saying that you know, quality is Plato, and quantity is Aristotle, and so you have these two foundational thinkers, and we have to integrate both things in our lives, I think. But yeah,
I really want to go with you on another talk about your belief that emotions and intellect are not separate. Oh, I want to sit and have a beer and let's talk.
Yeah, let's. I'll even make a note of it.
Make it, because that is a great conversation. And by the way, Maimonides, just to add to that quote, and I know we're talking about a lot of things here off the rails, but Maimonides, I would add something that I've never heard, but I believe it. When God said, let's make man in our own image, that the reference is to perfect masculinity and perfect femininity. And that is how we are made in that being, whatever it is, image. He is perfect masculinity, more portrayed in Old Testament, angry, ready to attack, and perfect femininity represented in Christ in the New. And I think that's how you have a masculinity and a femininity. I have it. And when the world can learn how to have them right in themselves, we'll be better off.
I think
that's my side thought.
Yeah, I think that's so true. My mother always said that she viewed God as a mother rather than a father.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe it said that in the New Testament, the word Abba, not the Swedish pop group, but the word Abba would have been used by Jesus, meaning daddy, when
that's
he talked
right.
about the Father God. And that's a really important concept, yeah.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, I just have to do a 20-second side thing here on that. Av is father in Hebrew.
Yeah.
Ava is Eve, and that's life. Avaha is love. So when you say Av, you're saying father. When you say Eve, you say Ava, you're saying life. And when you say Ahava, you're saying love. When you say his name, Yahweh, that is saying who he is. Now, the Jews in like Maimonides' time and beyond, they came up with this version of the Old Testament that was not the Septuagint, and they named him Jehovah or Yahweh. That is a lie. That's a misnomer. His name is Yahweh. And I'm sorry I'm ranting on that, but when I have a beard like this, I can do it.
You're allowed to, yeah. You want to throw any
Check
thunderbolts, that's fine too.
Check that information out. Don't say the Jehovah BS anymore. His name's Yahweh. Breath.
That sounds interesting and worth investigating. The tetragrammaton, the holy name that is spoken only once a year in the Holy of Holies.
He told them, make my name known. They hid it. I'm not anti-Semitic. Forget all that. Yeah.
No, and
it's information.
Absolutely. And it is a matter, it's information, and it's how we treat that information and whether we seek to do good with that information, whether we seek to achieve something positive. Okay. So the next one I have, and we're not going to get through these
trail.
Today. We're not going to get through this today, but predators pretend friendship and love, but feel absolutely nothing for others.
Yeah.
Comments?
I would say a four-letter word, yeah. You can't fabricate it. You can only pretend. And so there is the idea, intellectual idea of a friend or a loved one and caring about them. But there is also the fact that you just don't care about them. It's really the reality, you know. And that's why emotionally you can feel to care about them because they're hurt, they're in an accident, they're crying. But in reality, you're viewing their tears as an annoyance and as something that is grow up, shut up, I'm busy. And in your heart, that's kind of what you're saying. I've developed empathy inwardly from a source I attribute to superpower, but that I now have a real heart when I see people cry, but I never had it before. Before it was like, you're crying now? It was that kind of, we're laughing. It's terrible. That's a terrible human being. Yeah, but I mean, we're both laughing at it because it is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a potential that exists in all of us. You know, I'm not going to wander off into Jung's bizarre idea about a shadow or an anima animus or that kind of stuff. He was a nutcase. But I do
you think...
Do
you think Jung was a nutcase?
Oh, yeah. Look at his sex life, his obsession with corpses.
I gotta come fly over there and spend a month listening to you.
Dude, let's...
I had no idea he had a thing with corpses.
Yeah, they found a dead body when they were building a house for him in Switzerland. And he insisted that it be left there. He wanted it underneath his house. and he'd have photographs of corpses that he kept. But as a therapist, you know, that he was having sex with his patients, it's just, we're done. You know, that's not therapy. I think he and Freud are two of the most dangerous human beings who existed.
Any merit to their thought, any merit to the archetypes, any merit to the id and all that, nothing in your mind?
I think as metaphors, they're interesting, but they have to be seen as metaphors. There is actually no id. There is no, you know, little monster being inside us doing something. I think projection is a valid idea, mm-hmm. that we see our own faults in other people.
Mm-hmm. The mom, son, id, Electra, opiate. I can't remember as years, but none of that has merit.
The Oedipus complex, the other one you're thinking of, castration, fear, penis envy. Freud is describing himself as cult leaders tend to. And of course, Freud falls at seduction theory, as a brilliant man called Geoffrey Masson, who worked in the Freud archive, having fully qualified as a Freudian therapist. And he was shocked by the material he found there about the seduction theory, the idea that babies between 1 and 1.5 years old are trying to have sex with the parent of the opposite sex and trying to destroy the parent of the other sex between 1 and 1.5 years old. And what he found, it is in Ernest Jones' biography, and Jones was a big time devotee of Freud, but there's a letter that Jones puts in the autobiography where Freud says that he had to abandon seduction theory because it was unpopular and would make people not look at his other work. So he didn't put aside because he thought it was wrong. And what Masson found was that he thought it was profoundly true. He produced a book and was then, you know, ravaged by the Freudian cult, this community of people who are many of them medical doctors, highly educated, but to have their totems questioned in this way.
Challenge, yeah.
And this attack upon him was so significant that he never wrote on the subject again. This, I think the book was about 30 years ago. And he went off and wrote books about pets and things like that, which was a bit safer. Remarkable writer, really, really clever man. So I think there's this kind of tangle of thoughts inside Freudian ideas where occasionally there'll be something that pops up, which is kind of useful, but Electra complex, the Oedipus complex, no. With Jung and the archetypes, I think there's a value to saying that there do seem to be archetypal positions that we recognize. So, for example, the position of priest, mm-hmm. that in fact that archetype we use when we're looking, or some people use when they're looking at scientists, mm-hmm. that they accept what they're saying as truth.
Sure.
Because of their position, rather than questioning the evidence and coming to a conclusion of their own. So I think that can be useful, but they're metaphors, and we so easily make things literal. And when we do that, we find ourselves running on tram lines, unable to think anymore. So, some value, but
great not, value.
But I think too much has been put into those ideas. I don't think they're true, and that makes them rather dangerous. Another parallel thought would be, say, Konrad Lorenz's thinking about aggression, which fits in nicely. And when Franz de Waal, the psychologist, wrote Peacemaking Among Primates, which is a great book, published in the early 90s, he points out that there have been thousands of studies into aggression and two into reconciliation.
Wow.
And that imbalance, I think Lorenz, who was a Nazi, he's a professor in a German university, that this idea that we're fundamentally aggressive, we have to temper. And in the 90s, it was all about, you know, we're part chimp, part bonobo. Well, more contemporary understanding of evolution says it is irrelevant how other primates behave because we have the power of thought. we can change our minds. And we don't have to be, you know, on the savannah, we locked in all of these little modes of thinking, these modules that persist. It's a dream world. So I think there is better thinking than Freud and Jung. But we should acknowledge what was useful. And accept that they were both deeply flawed human beings. They were both psychiatrically ill, and we should be aware of that. So Freud, for example, the idea of having the couch and having somebody lie on the couch is because he didn't like people looking at him.
Wow.
So he could sit behind them, you know. But
we can't help this, John. I have to go down. I've been rabbit holing my mind with everything. I want everything you've said. I have something to add, but I have to ask you on this. Do you believe that mental illness is something that denigrates a man or a woman's work?
No.
No. So it doesn't. Does their moral turpitude challenge the value of their work in your mind?
Let's make, you know, two clear cases. If we're talking about, say, Einstein and relativity theory and his ideas on Brownian motion and you know, this guy, and we then find out that he wrote letters to his, I think, second wife about his adulterous relationships, which is a bit weird, has no effect at all upon his scientific work, because his scientific work can be checked using evidence and mathematics. If we then look to Freud, Jung, Adler, any other group, you know, Rogers, and these many people who've put forward ideas, Fritz Perls, and we find that they suffered from moral turpitude, and yet they are advancing a system that is meant to make us moral, then we have to be suspicious. If they are saying that they're going to teach us how to be rational and how to analyze things rationally, if we find that they weren't, then yes, it directly affects. And I made this argument, in fact, in the original 1990 version of my book, Let's Sell These People a Piece of Blue Sky, the publisher actually took a chapter out.
Wow.
And that chapter was basically saying, look, I've shown that Hubbard was a liar. I've shown that he was a confidence trickster. But the value of his system must be judged independently of that. And I use Freud as an example, having read Anthony Storr's wonderful Feet of Clay. Read a lot more about Freud since. That Freud, we have to question whether he actually ever, in his terms, resolved the transference. Did he ever really grow up? This is a man who didn't speak to his own father for 2 years because he was sure that his father must have sexually abused him when he was an infant.
Wow.
And he believed that about everybody. There's a wonderful Adam Curtis, who made stupid comments about Scientology, but we'll put that aside. He made a series of documentaries called The Century of the Self, which looks at the Freud family, you know, how Anna Freud, for example, influenced family therapy when she'd only worked with four children. And they were four children of a family, a rich family, that were all given to her to bring up. And she watched them, did what she did, and then told us how to bring children up. Well, one of them became an alcoholic and one of them committed suicide. So I don't think she really knew that much. And we then, you know, get on to, we can, the whole Freud family, he goes right through to Jeremy Freud, the great-grandson, who gave us placement in advertising. The idea that you can, and of course we have Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda and PR, who is a double nephew of Freud on both sides. He's a nephew of Freud's. And, you know, the whole basis of, you know, using sex to sell things comes out of that, which is an interesting idea, but it, scientifically, it's not true. Sex is not the main way of selling things. Peculiarly, liking or creating a sense of friendship or humor is much more effective, according to studies of advertising. But nonetheless, this cynical way of manipulating people that Freud is good, no, don't like it, and it's not necessary or good.
All right, thank you for that.
Of course, thank you for asking. It's always a pleasure to talk with an intelligent person. What can I say? And amazingly, most people are to some degree intelligent. But you're asking the right questions.
You get them to tell this. Get it out of their mouth, you know, and talk, right?
Yeah. And that brings us very much to our next point, and we probably won't go on much further than this, but because of what I've just said to you, predators are charming and good at flattery, but don't mean a single word of it.
That's my forte. My family all laughs wherever I can't help it. Mm. And the problem is, people look at the package and they hear the words and they think that I would be a nice guy, but I'm not. And that's why this is so important to me, because these facades, these flatteries, this charm, you know, the look, and that's one reason I do this. And I want to make myself not look trustworthy. I really do. I want people not to make me something, because I am, and from my honest of heart, I'm really not a good guy. I have to work to be a good guy. Don't make me your hero. And I'm a little crazy too, so don't make me your philosopher. You know, and don't look at my moral life. It hasn't been good. There's no reason to heroize, but I don't think we should really heroize anybody. I think all of us should. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, my email address for a long time was anti-guru.
Oh, good. And yes.
I was working this out the other week, that I like to be appreciated for what I do.
Yes.
But I do not like to be adulated for what I do.
Right.
It's disgusting.
But that's such a healthy sign. That's such a good sign about who you are. And that goes hand in hand with what has helped redeem me and give me some tools, is that you are self-effacing in an honest way. And that says to me that your soul wants to be transparent and clear. But our corporations and government and entertainment industry is the absolute opposite of that. And they reign.
Yeah,
so I applaud anybody like you who I meet them. Because after, like you just said, you talk to somebody for a little while, you know what their words reveal them, you know, and how they present reveals them. We need more of that to protect ourselves from dangerous people. You know, more honesty. And I just really love what you've done. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, the question of encouragement, I was probably a child of about 8 when I realized that people don't encourage one another. And my friend, Rachel Bernstein, a brilliant therapist in LA, we were talking a few years ago, and she said that she'd had this class, adult class, and she'd had them. She said, write down a time when you're at school when a teacher discouraged you, and write down a time when a teacher encouraged you. And she said something like, I'm not sure that anybody in the class, having had, you know, 13 years in school, anybody in the class felt they'd been encouraged by a teacher.
Wow.
And I think that's a terrible condemnation of our system. So I realized as a kid that it'd be good to encourage people. And I was probably about 20 by the time I realized that a hell of a lot of people view that with suspicion. When you say to somebody, oh, you know, you've done that really well, or, you know, I like the way your hair is. I don't tend to compliment people on their hair unless they've got a great beard, obviously. You know, but there is so much discouragement in our society. And so we get to this thing, this notion of flattery. A friend of mine a few years ago said, you know, anything can be used for good or evil, which is a kind of simplistic thought. And he said, for example, flattery. And I said, well, the word flattery means insincere praise. How can that have a positive use? And he hadn't looked it up. He thought it meant praise. It doesn't. It means insincere praise. So it's a bit confusing, because when you say to somebody, well, I feel flattered, what are you saying to them? It seems to me that you learned how to use insincere praise. You learned how to get people where you wanted them by love bombing them, by making them feel good.
I'm going to diverge from, I'm typically pretty on point with my failures, but when I think about it, John, my skill is praising sincerely on things that are not typically observed in the person.
Mm-hmm.
So when you point out something about a person that you know they're not getting good encouragement for, they feel like you really know them better. So, and you encourage them in a way. So it, my flattery was manipulative because it was to get them to trust me that I knew them well, but I never used flattery I didn't mean or that wasn't there. I used what was there that was usually unrecognized in them. So you take a girl who's typically unattractive and you point something out about her features that are attractive. She's not used to hearing that. So like you, if she has a wonderful mouth or beautiful teeth or one aspect of her overall presence that isn't really attractive, they die for that. They love that because, and I find that part truly beautiful. So that's how you are successful, is when you compliment in a real way on something they're not used to hearing.
That, I mean, that immediately goes to Charles Manson. But this is, yeah, this is how Charles Manson brought women to himself. And in the Manson murder gang, family seems the wrong word somehow, there was a ratio of about four women to one man.
Yeah.
And the women were, you know, say, Patricia Krenwinkel, who is still in prison, which I think is ludicrous 54 years later, because she is not going to hurt anybody. But she had a hormonal thing where she had more body hair than is usual. And Manson would do this thing of saying, you're beautiful. And I think, as you say, that he was able to home in on some aspect of their femininity that was praiseworthy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he then did a lot of other things to them, including awful amount of Scientology. But that love bombing, that first contact, in opening our minds, I cite the Al-Qaeda recruiting manual, which I got my hands on.
Wow.
And you see this thing, never disagree with a person. Never. Agree with them. Now, in Scientology recruiting, this is called finding their reality. And of course, Manson was trained in that. Yeah. So this thing of getting next to a person and you have an ulterior motive.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it manipulative, that you're not doing it to make them feel good. If I praise somebody, I'm just doing it to make them feel good. I remember a specific instance. We were out in a town in Cornwall here, and I'm hesitating because how much of the story to tell. But I was actually doing an intervention with a Scientologist, and so. I was a bit hesitant about being on the streets because they have people following you. And you know, we'd had a bit of a problem the month before. And I hear this lad playing Peruvian pipes. And he's just so good at it. And I thought, okay, there's something I can do about this. So he's about, I don't know, 11, 12 years old. And he's on the street playing pan pipes. He obviously doesn't have a busker's license or anything like that. But I just walked up to him and I gave him I think it was a £20 note. And the reason it stuck is that he then followed me along the street. And I don't want people. But it was that thought, you know, maybe somebody walking into his life at this point, a complete stranger, saying, you're really talented.
Yeah.
Will mean that his life will change, but that he'll feel a confidence in himself that he didn't have before.
Yes.
And in a society that is so thoroughly discouraging and wants to make us all little pegs to fit into holes, you know, and do as we're told, I think it is very important to do that. But it's really important to tell people, if somebody you don't know, like me, walks up to you on the street and tells you how fabulous you are, be careful.
Careful, yeah.
Yeah. They probably aren't your best friend.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, just to put a light note on it for me, once I had my change, I enhanced that element of my personality to compliment people on everything I can possibly see that's good in them. And I mean it now. I don't have any ulterior motive, but you are right. When you are a complimenter, you are viewed with suspicion. People think you have something that you're out to get now. And especially if you have no ulterior motive, you don't couch it in any way except you're beautiful. Well, you say that to a woman today, Or you say to a, anybody, you say to a kid, I love your hair, and she's seven, they think you're a pedophile.
Exactly.
Or you're beautiful, they think you're a rapist. Yeah. Everybody's on edge now about a compliment. Mm-hmm. Funny.
Yeah. And so you'll find people who recruit you to their cause, their idea, or whatever it is they're selling, the product, with some little compliment. And it'll be a little compliment. It won't be, wow, you're fantastically beautiful. Mm-hmm. It will be, you know, I love the color of your scarf, or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. starts you off. And you can see the change in people. I mean, as I say, I started doing it as an 8-year-old child, just feeling that it was right to do this. Mm. It was nice. And as a teenager, realized some people are, you know, is it cupboard love? You know, this is what I want. Yeah. So a great, you know, put this on your fridge at home and let your kids read it. And they're less likely to be caught up in an abusive relationship. Yeah. With an individual or a cult group.
How do people get that? I've got my copy of your list. How do other people get it?
Well, it's up on a website. So we'll put a link in the description, and people are most welcome to it. And of course we would also like to see comments. And I mean, when we first met, and this is only our third meeting, but I came away from that conversation fascinated, because it's like, I've just met one of the most charming people I've ever met, and that's saying something. Mm. And he's told me I shouldn't trust him. Okay. Predators brag and boast and make up outrageous lies. When challenged, they blame others.
Yeah.
Reflect on that, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, hard to have the ego. Everything's you, everything's ego. So when you're challenged, that's still probably a difficulty I have in my personality. I don't think anybody really likes to be criticized or challenged, but it was pathological. It was really, you could tell something was wrong with me if you could see how I handled in my younger years, criticism or resistance. It was always would turn to me going violent. If it was my mother or father who were being critical, I would break everything I could get a hold of. I couldn't hurt them, but I could smash things in the house and intimidate, you know. And that was the way I would be with people in life too.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's not an exaggeration. I can still be pushed to that point, but it takes a lot. The thing is I'm humbled. Because not more than 6 months ago, I was pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and I lost it. I grabbed a baseball bat, and I was ready to swing. And it was only years of that I realized, okay. But the guy with the bat, that's me. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No okay. one. And relative to what you're doing here, John, I don't think people realize when you walk in a liquor store and you see a man who looks like he's dangerous, that guy's dangerous. These people are dangerous. Mm. I look like I'm dangerous, even though I'm not in my heart anymore. Mm. Trust that, because people who look that way have been wounded and they're ready to fight and hurt. Mm. And so you go into a 7-Eleven, I don't know if you have those in the UK, but you go into a liquor
stores,
store.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you bump into somebody, a man who has a face that has a countenance that his eyes say, do not mess with me. Don't mess with them. Mm. Just don't mess with them. It's a really tough way to live, because you become distrustful, but it's important for your safety, you know? My daughters don't always realize, because their dad, they've seen me as a pretty good man now, and they don't always realize that other men are dangerous. Mm. They kind of tie who I am to, and it's kind of frightening. So I'm rambling right now because I'm not really putting much thought into it, but be careful. People who look dangerous are probably dangerous.
And trust has to be earned.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
You don't, it's not Christian to be kind to somebody you don't know and who is taking advantage of you. It's Christian to be wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. Mm. I mean, come on. But all these tropes of how to behave are ridiculous. We need to get smarter.
Yeah, I mean, as I was first investigating, you know, back in the 80s, how people become involved in cults, that was a significant element that we were brought up to trust.
Yeah.
We were brought up to accept what we were told. We were not taught to be disobedient. We were not taught to think. And as you say, so much of this is obvious, that when you look at the guy in the 7-Eleven and he's glowering at you, it reminds me of Kent Keel, who I think in The Psychopath Whisperer talks about doing an interview with a guy who was in prison for murder. And the guy looked at him, he said, "But I was in the bar. And if this guy had looked at you the way he looked at me, you'd have killed him too."
Mm.
And that, realizing there's this other way of viewing the world.
Yeah. You're like a primate. I mean, you really almost like are a primate. Mm. And when you look at a silverback wrong, that's fighting words. I mean, whether it's wrong or not, you know, I don't know. It's just a frightening thing. And it seems to me that when I look around, knowing what's in people, that I see more and more violent tendencies, not less. I don't see less, but maybe I'm looking into it.
Yeah, it's difficult to make a comparison, you know, without looking at statistics. And we're told that violence has actually diminished slightly in Western society since the 1990s. And some people in the US, there's the idea that it was maybe the Roe v. Wade case, that women were not being forced to bring up children they didn't want. And so those children who would, of course, not be very happy, were not being born. That it's a potential argument. What about bragging and boasting?
Before we go on to it, this is a perfect lead-in. David Miscavige, bragging and boasting. We just talked about the stereotypical hoodlum at 7-Eleven. But there's also that need to look at people who present themselves perfectly in life, as you got to be very aware of them too.
Yeah.
Because David Miscavige, you would never look at him and think he's dangerous. But boy, if you look at what is driving this man to have this appearance and to be dressed like this and speak, what is he about? He's as big of a threat as the thug.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I just had to make that before we went on. That's the parallel to the next point, which is, what's the parallel?
Well, I can't remember. Let's actually emphasize that. You mentioned Mother Teresa as exemplifying saintly behavior. Well,
yeah,
it's not in the least bit true.
Right.
She was a terrible, terrible human being.
I've heard that.
So, I mean, there's a three-part BBC series about her where you have I didn't realize just how many people had followed her. Thousands of women became nuns in her order. And one of them says, "Well, you know, I'd heard about this thing called the discipline, and I would go into the communal lavatories and I would hear these women exclaiming and this thwacking noise. And then one day I was considered good enough to receive the discipline. And the discipline is a knotted rope that you use to flagellate yourself with." And she tried hitting herself on the back, and it didn't sound like the sound she was hearing from the other cubicles. And she realized that these women were paddling themselves on their inner thighs. And she also realized that the noises they were making were orgasmic noises. And she's sort of going, "What on earth does that have to do with a saintly life?" This idea of masochistic pleasure, you know, the Catholic Church particularly doesn't seem to have understood the psychology of masochism. And that's just insane.
Wow.
So, yeah. And also, of course, she refused painkillers to people who are dying so that they would fully experience their pain so they could receive Jesus. Not good. So sometimes, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Sheep's clothing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So bragging and boasting, was that something that you were good at?
Became more and more proficient at. It's kind of gender specific in some ways. My brother-in-law was a collegiate women's volleyball coach, and he always used to say, if you take a group of almost Olympic level women and say, are you good? They'll say, I'm okay. I try, you know, I'm okay. And then if you take a seventh grader who's never played basketball boy and say, are you good? I'm the best. I can beat anybody. So there's kind of some gender stuff with braggadocio.
Yeah.
So I had that, but I learned no one really likes a braggart. And so then I learned to brag better. And now I really disdain humble braggers. You know, oh, it's really hard to make ends meet with both kids at Harvard and Oxford. And just shut up. So I'm really attuned to bragging, and I don't like it now. It's the antithesis somewhat to humility. So, but when I was really messed up, yeah, bragging was a big part of it.
And I mean, the last part of that, let's put my specs back on. Brag and boast and make up outrageous lies. Did you make up any outrageous lies?
That was fun back in the day. The more outrageous, the more people were stunned. You know, I admitted in the first book I wrote that I was a fibber. They call them fibbers. And I was a big fibber. Yeah.
Okay. Then move on to and I think this is there's a difference, and I think in looking at malignant narcissists like Hubbard, their tendency is to be cowardly. Whereas there is a completely other way where some people with sociopathic disorder, antisocial personality, they don't feel anxiety or fear.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with anxiety and fear?
Pretty indifferent to all levels of physical fear. Would jump off a high place. I would do the crazy things. I had no fear. It was really stupidity, but no fear. And I still don't have much. I don't have fear of high speeds. I don't have fear of dangerous situations. That never. But I think I did fear being exposed in my heart. And I think that was there. Maybe a truly level 10 sociopath doesn't even care about that. I don't know. But I did have some concern about being discovered for what I really was.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that's good. Predators are impulsive and easily bored. They demand thrills and take dangerous risks. They enjoy pushing others into taking dangerous risks too. Impulsive
Definitely.
And easily bored.
Yeah, I'm still that way. If you could see where I'm sitting, I'm sitting in a room that's full of projects, and I have to constantly, I have 20 books in the queue. I've got art in here. And I have to constantly work because I am bored like that. I can't take it.
I mean, I think we probably share that. I have three older brothers, and we all of us have to keep our minds and our hands busy.
Yeah.
And they found their ways of dealing with that, and they've all three of them achieved remarkable things. I had a friend who one day boasted to me that he'd spent 8 hours lying on the couch watching golf.
Oh gosh.
And sort of, what kind of vegetable are you? You know, I mean, awful. But
I couldn't do it.
I tempered it by, I learned meditation in a Zen monastery when I was 18. And I can sit in a waiting room and, you know, go back into myself and not need to think anything. But it took years to acquire that because my mind's busy. I'm looking for something. So I'm easily bored as well. Does that mean?
Oh, you got one of the points.
As predators are bullies with explosive tempers.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't have to say a lot about that, do we?
Not much needed there. Not anymore, though.
No, thankfully for us all. And again, I think, you know, that's something I don't have. My temper is explosive when it comes forward, as sadly my lovely wife can say. But it you won't see much of it. That'll be a few times a year.
Yeah.
And it's not a positive trait, really isn't. Yeah. You know, there comes a point where I've just had enough. But
yeah.
I think you could perhaps every day have just had enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We then go on to predators are cunning and manipulative.
Definitely.
Mm.
Yeah.
Doesn't
cunning,
seem to
manipulative, criminal. Definitely yep. criminal.
We get into criminal.
Oh, sorry.
We have predators enjoy humiliating people.
I would only enjoy humiliating proud people. Mm. When I was younger and less in control, I would humiliate weak people.
Mm.
And that breaks my heart. Proud people, I still don't have too big of a problem humiliating that. And that's that God complex I have. But people who are suffering, I really feel badly for ever humiliating them. Yeah. And so I don't do. Yeah.
That is an essential transformation. I mean, I'm like you in that if I see somebody being arrogant and aggressive towards somebody else, I will jump right in.
Yeah.
I can remember I was at art college. I was, 22 or something. And we had an art history lecture. And so I was, you know, the other people would be like 17 or 18.
Mm.
And they were used to the idea of being in school and calling people sir. And this arrogant guy, there was a young woman there and she'd confused Manet and Monet.
Oh.
And he had a go at her for it in front of the whole class. And I just don't like that.
Yeah,
so when he got the date of Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon wrong by 6 months, I corrected him.
Oh.
And bless him, you know, I expected that this would annoy him. And he actually came up to me afterwards and said, you should take an advanced level in art history.
Wow.
So I did. I didn't go to any more of his classes. But there's just something about that
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, we have this thing in our schools, they say praise in public, reprimand in private, which I think for a school teacher is a good idea.
Good thing, yeah.
But I will reprimand in public if somebody has done something bullying in public.
Yeah.
It's maybe why I ended up with Scientology on the other side of the court.
Might be.
Predators weaken people with insults and put downs.
Yeah, in the right setting. Yeah, definitely.
Mm.
In the extreme. Yeah.
Okay. Predators hate it if anyone else has power or is praised. For the predator, life is a competition and they want to win.
Yeah, I could see that completely through my teenage life and mind and my young 20s. Definitely.
Mm.
Till I came to what I experienced. Definitely. Everything. Yeah. Mm. Competition.
Okay. Predators lie easily and think nothing of breaking a promise.
Yeah. No promise. Who cares?
And
terrible. Terrible state to
yeah,
be
absolutely, absolutely. And it takes us, you know, it certainly takes me to it has taken me to a perception that we have to have compassion for people who are born with or you know, nurture seems the wrong word, conditioned into this behavior to understand. But we have to make this differentiation to understand, you know, hate the sin, but love the sinner, right? It's been said. To understand that we have to be very careful. You know, if you've got Hannibal Lecter, you need to put a mask on him because he'll bite your nose off otherwise.
Yeah.
So having that balance of wanting somebody to escape this condition.
Yeah.
To be liberated from this awful condition.
Yeah.
But also being aware that until they are, you shouldn't trust them, as you've told us not to do with you. You seem pretty trustworthy to me, I must say, so far.
Boy, I'm fooling
Don't believe
you,
it. Don't believe it.
But here's the thing, John. And for the past, you know, 20 some odd years, I would be the person you could trust in certain situations. that I don't want to take credit for it, but I know that if we were together and you were in danger, you would have a friend who would go to the nth degree to protect you now.
Yeah.
So those traits have, yes, they're there, and yes, they're not good, and I anti-guru all the way. But I have been able to a power much greater than me, learn to take those bad things and use them in a good way, in the right way now. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think for all of us that if we overcome a difficulty in ourselves, that it makes us much stronger and it makes us more aware and more competent. Okay. Predators are without conscience. They do not feel remorse or guilt.
Yeah.
No. I mean, that's the fundamental criterion that led to the idea of the psychopath, which is a lot more modern than people generally realize. It's Hervey Cleckley in The Mask of Sanity in the 1940s who gives us the first definitions of this, even though the word's been with us since the 1840s. In the First World War, the term psychopath was used about malingerers. They realized they'd got a lot of people in their hospital beds who had nothing wrong with them, other than they really didn't want to go and get killed. Yeah. And there's a certain degree of sense to that, you know.
Yeah.
Get killed in a stupid cause. You know?
Yeah.
Predators often boast about the harm they've done to other people.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but because I was boastful, if I was able to humiliate somebody who I thought deserved it, yes, that would be the case.
Okay.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Good. Predators are parasites and lazy, living off others, giving as little as possible in return.
Yeah, I really was criminally minded when I was younger, and even into my 30s before I had the roadside experience. I was a securities broker, and in that job, everything is asset under management. The more assets you have, the better of a earner you're going to be, but through commissions. And I never could hear a couple who had worked their whole life saving. I never could hear their concerns about the safety of their money. All I could hear was, how do I get a commission out of them? And so when you put that kind of personality in that kind of job, people get hurt. Yeah. It's the wrong mix up. Unfortunately, you will thrive if you have that mentality in industries that pay off commission and things like that. So I wish I could start some kind of charge against commission-based security sales in the world. Because when you put somebody's ability to have money in the bank compared to doing the right thing for people with money, you're going to prey on them. And I was a predator upon them. And it's sad to me, you know. That's a side issue again, but yes, no care for anybody's well-being. And I feel badly about that. I can think of certain faces of couples. In fact, I wrote a novel about this.
Oh, believe wow. It.
I wrote a novel about the process. And it's just so contrary to charge, to cause customers to pay you to convince them to do something when their interest is always going to be secondary, always. It should be outlawed. It should be outlawed. I wish we could do something about that.
Yeah, and I mean, having seen the damage that the hedge fund scandals of 2007 and 8 caused all over the world, that our grandchildren will be paying for what those wolves of Wall Street took from us.
Yeah, horrible human beings. Yeah, they're not good human beings. So I was one of them, but with all my propensities, the only difference would be if the old man came and complained that I lost him money, I would be like, you sure you want to complain about this? You know? So I had a double. I laugh about it now, but it's still horrible.
Yeah. I mean, it's so often been observed through Hollywood, but the movie Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful.
And that especially the Jack Lemmon character.
Oh, yeah. You are so well read and so well exposed to great things. That movie is just proverbial. We orbit in similar ways and similar things, you and I.
Yeah, and I mean, in this case, I've spent years looking at, you know, what exemplifies authoritarian behavior. You know, how is predatory behavior expressed? And I think that creative expression of these things, I'd be fascinated to see your novel. I don't know if we'll ever have the time to read it, but I'd love
Oh, it
to
would
see
kill
it.
you. It is so tedious. It's
Oh, okay.
600 page of tediousness because I'm trying to get to it. But it's a good overall message. Yeah, but man, it's tedious.
Okay, well, we'll put that aside. I mean,
Put that aside.
I'm watching Billions at the moment with Damian
Oh,
Lewis.
there's a perfect example. That's a perfect example. How hollow can you be as a human being?
And you see both sides of it. The Giamatti, Paul Giamatti character,
you
he
do.
just doesn't realize that he's a psychopath and he's
Yeah.
got all of the wrong reasons, you know. But
Yeah.
yeah,
Have
fascinating.
you watched The Inheritance one? Is it Inheritance?
No, I don't.
Succession.
Succession. Yeah, absolute twice all the way
Brilliant.
through. Oh.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And the idea that the whole plot is you've got these four kids and it's which one of them's going to get the goods. And it just keeps going through four
Oh.
seasons with that. Beautifully played,
Yeah.
beautifully scripted. And Brian
Yeah.
Cox, you know, that moment, the boar on the floor, where he just
Yeah.
humiliates everybody in the room, you know. Oh, scary. And
Yeah.
they are the people who run the world, of course. Oh, dear.
Yes.
Predators are control freaks, stopping others from taking control of anything if they can.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely all the way through. Have had to learn. I'm the opposite of it now. It's one of those things where if it changes, it goes the opposite direction. I like if you were once a smoker, often you will hate cigarette smoke later
I
when you
do.
quit. Do you?
Yeah, I
Yeah.
do. I
I
quit
am that
25 years ago. Yeah.
opposite. Yeah. Yeah. I cannot stand that anymore. Yeah.
That's good. We've got two more left. So I didn't think we were going to do this. I think
A
we'll make
long
it in one.
list.
But as we've got to talk about emotion and thought next time, we've got to get this done.
Yes.
So let's put our shoulders to the wheel and our backs to the grindstone and
Do
row
it
our
again.
paddle our canoe. Predators force petty rules on others, rules that are impossible to follow.
I think we're getting into a higher level of psychosis or something, because I don't remember being that advanced.
Okay. And it's too late to work on it now
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
That's just repulsive to me now.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
I mean, that's something, it's a difficult one, because people with obsessive compulsive disorder, people with Asperger's may also, you know, I as I say, I have the order disorder. I remember watching a brilliant documentary called Time Is All You've Got about Artie Shaw, the clarinetist, jazz clarinetist, swing clarinetist of the 30s. And he was married seven times. And they interviewed several of his ex-wives. And one of them said, if you didn't fold the top of the toilet paper right, you know, into a little triangle or something, a little peak, you'd be told off. And Shaw was, I don't think there's any suggestion that he was a predator. He was a creative genius. There's no doubt about that. But I think a part of his genius, you know, he was, I think, 19 when he became a worldwide success. And he just wanted to earn the money so he could go to Juilliard and study properly. And then when he went there, he found that they didn't have anything to teach him, because he'd already gone further than their rule book said, in, you know, the same way that Louis Armstrong did with the trumpet. But I think that precision of mind, it's partly what means that I do take notice of the world and sort of put it into categories and think about it in a certain way, because it's untidy to me otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be ordered. We have just one. Let's
Yeah.
go ahead.
Before you do, I'm looking back, I was that way actually. Very, and I'm still that way. Little tiny things I'll get on people hard if it's just not done the right orderly way. So that's actually more applicable than I thought it was.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that brings us finally to predators boast about tricking other people and breaking the law.
Yeah, I break all laws. I have no respect for any law. It's terrible. Still, yeah.
Well,
I'm an anarchist, hardcore in my soul. I only obey the law now because I think it is for the better good, and that's incumbent upon me as someone who claims to walk a better life. But I have no regard for any law anywhere. I'm lawless. I'm laughing because it's so bad. But I do have to choose constantly. Every stoplight, every right turn, no right turn, every single command, I have to decide to not break it. Yeah, and I break many of them still if they're superfluous in my mind.
Well, yeah, as Jesus said, the law is made for man, not man for the law.
Yeah.
And I think, again, we have something very much in common here that I have never been able to do as I'm told.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have to think about stuff and go, do I want to do that? And I thought that was a real fault when I was a kid. And now I'm 68 years old. I think it, you know, it's not kind of a knee-jerk reaction. I'm not going to do it because you're telling me to do it. It's a sort of, I want to make the decision about what I do.
Right. I want the liberty to choose myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, big time.
Well, that brings us to the end of the list. Do you have anything?
Yes, I have three quick questions for you, which have nothing to do with what we've talked about.
Excellent.
I'm just going to throw three books at you that I have. They have had a profound impact on me. And we've already mentioned one of them, Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yeah.
You've read that.
Yep.
One other book question, Master Ludi or The Glass Beads Game by Hermann Hesse?
Oh, mind-boggling. I read it when I was 18, and yeah. I've never got over it.
No.
The idea of a society that has lost its way to creativity and has put everything into a set of rules. I think he calls it the age of feuilleton, or the age of the journalist. And it's a model that I was later told comes from Goethe, that you start out and you have primitive creativity, and then you have a kind of Renaissance creativity where you learn how to do things, and then you have a kind of ornamental, decorative, Baroque, Rococo thing, and then you come back to, well, what we have right now. And it was amazing for me as an artist, I'm a painter, and that's fundamentally what I do, to realize through the late 70s that this was what was happening, that conceptualism was going to push the object out of art. And we were going to have, you know, and sometimes you have somebody like Maurizio Cattelan, who's absolutely brilliant and insightful. But Damien Hirst, Jeff Koons, Tracy Emin, it's a joke. You know, people who don't know anything trying to tell me how to think, or, you know, to tell me that I should be full of angst and upset and distress about the world. And it's like, come on, that's not helpful, you know?
Wonderful.
Okay. Very, very important.
We've got that. And then just one more that's just passing by, but The True Believer.
Eric Hoffer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are amazing. I've met a soulmate here.
Absolutely.
What did you think?
It's a vital book towards the understanding of manipulation and influence. And it started me on my way. I read it in the year after I left Scientology. And I mean, and you extend that further, Brave New World, 1984, This Perfect Day by Ira Levin, things that, and Huxley's Brave New World Revisited, where he assesses, and he's basically saying his friend George Orwell was wrong. That Brave New World is what we've got to worry about, the Soma, and here we are living in the Brave New World, you know, with the advertisers and the corporate giants. And, you know, the new part of the Brave New World, of course, is artificial intelligence. Which is a long and deep conversation all of its own.
Fascinating. There's several others really at the top, but we'll do those for next time.
Yeah, excellent. Let's do that. This has been a tremendous pleasure for me.
And for me,
thank
too.
You.
I found a friend. Thank you, brother.
Yeah, likewise. And we're going to do this again in a few weeks' time, because I am fascinated by your perspective. And it is really interesting to find so much common ground that by thinking about the world and rebelling against the world, and by the way, politically, I too am an anarchist, not of the blowing things up variety, but and how we get there, I don't know. But the current plutocracy that is called democracy in the United States is just appalling. And in this country too, we've had one millionaire prime minister after another, and they are, you know, and people like Tony Blair, who went off and I think he made $25 million in the first year after he left office. And you're going, and you're a socialist, right?
Yeah.
What sense of the word? But fantastic.
Oh, we'll have to talk about that.
We will, we will, we will.
And all that.
Great. Okay, well, thank you very much today. We will switch off the recording and arrange our next for our next conversation. Okay. And it's been, I hope that people watching this can take just a little of the pleasure I've had from this conversation and the insight that you've shared.
No, mine too. I can't wait to get a look at your book, Piece of the Blue Sky, right?
Piece of Blue Sky. Yeah, let's sell these people a piece of blue sky. If you do ebooks, I can send it to you like that. Personally, I need paper.
I'll purchase it. Yeah. I will get to it because I want to know more about your mind. I think, and then we will ultimately start promoting from our end too all that we've done together and what you're doing. Mm. So we haven't jumped on it because I'm waiting till there's and we're kind of in disarray, but it's coming.
Great. Yeah.
Look forward to
Fantastic.
It.
Fantastic. Wonderful talking with you, Sean.
You too, John.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.